welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today is my last show for 2020. I will be back in about 3 weeks, taking a little bit of time off for holidays and the family. And I wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Let's pray to God that next year is a whole lot better than this one. And when I do come back in 2021, I'm going to do a rundown of this past year, which is very exciting because if you missed any of the shows, then maybe you'll get a little snippet of what you missed, and you might want to go back and listen to one of those great episodes that I had so many fantastic guests on. It was just phenomenal. Before I get into today's episode with the ghost biker, Miranda Young, I will put her links in the bottom of the show notes. We will get to Miranda here in a couple minutes, but I want to give a shout out to Carrie Boros. She works with my daughter, and my daughter Natalie tells me she is a big fan of mine, loves the podcast, and she requested a video of my 1998 documentary, Ghosts in the Valley. So, Carrie, I have a copy being sent out to you, and I hope you enjoy it. Thank you, Carrie, for listening and subscribing and being a follower. I appreciate it. And to all of you out there who follow and share my podcast, I really do appreciate it. I appreciate every one of you. This has been a tough year with the elections and with COVID, and if you lost a loved one to this deadly disease, my prayers go out to you. I know my son, my sister-in-law, my three cousins, numerous friends have all had it, and it's not pleasant. So let's hope 2021 is a whole lot better than 2020. So let's get into my interview with ghost biker Miranda Young. Okay, today we have the one and only ghost biker, Miranda Young. Welcome, Miranda, to Ghost in the Valley podcast.
Thank you for having me, Al. Excited to be here.
I see that you are a paranormal investigator, an artist, founder of Ghost Biker Explorations, a photographer, a videographer, and a biker chick. How about if I include historian as well?
Absolutely. I actually prefer historian because with a lot of my videos, I like to really highlight the history. And that's always usually first and foremost. And then if I'm able to get something paranormal at these locations, that's just icing on the cake. So often I'll call myself a paranormal historian.
Yeah, because, you know, I've been to some of these sites that you've been to, and some historians don't cover it as well as you do. I mean, I watched a couple of your videos, and I mean, you do an exceptional job. I love it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, my videos are typically three-part, being a biker and a historian. I always cover the travel to that location and then the history or the story as to why I'm there, as well as some kind of interesting historical fact about the small town. And then the last part is the paranormal investigation. So I really pride myself in trying to cover as much history and tell as much of the story as I can in these videos.
Yeah, no, I've been following the Ghost Biker Explorations. And can you explain to my listeners to what the Ghost Biker Explorations is all about?
Sure, absolutely. So I've been a paranormal investigator for around 10 years now. I started out with a team, and I was brought on to the team because of my background in photography. And so they brought me on to look at some different photos and try to debunk some of the things that they were finding on some of their investigations. And one photo turned into two, and two turned into 10, and 10 turned into 20. And they ended up inviting me on an investigation to pay me back for looking at all these these photos. And so the investigation went really well, had some great Class A EVPs as well as some other great evidence during the investigation. And so they ended up inviting me to join the team. And I was on the team for 8 years. And I found that when I wasn't investigating with the team, we would typically, you know, go to different locations, maybe once a month. And some of them were residential as well as commercial locations. But I found whenever I wasn't investigating with the team, I was always out traveling on my motorcycle to different locations that had a really rich history or were maybe somewhere that people wouldn't really think about visiting. And I was putting these photos and putting the stories of my travels up on my social media and was getting a lot of questions about it. And so I was just kind of thinking and talking to a friend of mine, and, you know, he was real encouraging about, you know, maybe you should really document all of this through video. And so sat down and came up with a media plan and branding, and that's where Ghost Biker Explorations was born. I ended up leaving the team after, like I said, after 8 years, because I was doing so much on the team, everything from the photo analyzing to their branding and their social media and helping to put their videos together, that, you know, I didn't feel it was really fair to, you know, try to do both. I needed to, you know, devote 100% of my time to one or the other. So I ended up stepping away from the team and doing Ghost Biker Explorations. And it's really taken off. It's took off a lot quicker than I thought it would, and been going strong. Just finished up our third season. Looking forward to moving forward with the fourth next year.
Yeah, I've seen a few of the episodes. I'll get to those in a little bit. I was a videographer myself and photographer years ago, and I have my own company, production company. And so I was looking at your videos and your photos of your on your site, and it's like, man, it blew me away because you had really great coverage. And I don't know if you're using a drone for overhead.
I am.
A really, really job well done. And I think the person with you, is his name Jason?
Josh. He was with me in my first and second season. And due to COVID and some family obligations that he had this past year, I had several different friends kind of step in, as well as I filmed vlog style on this third season. But Josh was the one that followed me on the first two seasons.
Josh. Okay. Yeah. You mentioned him a couple times, and I didn't know, you know, what your team consisted of, you know, how many people.
For myself, I'm a solo investigator. I do collaborations, but I have to keep things really simple being out on the motorcycle and everything. So I've been able to really kind of work to consolidate the equipment that I have, and as far as the investigation as well as the filming. So I always have my drone with me, as well as several different cameras. I use static cameras. I don't use them a whole lot, but because I am one person, and the way that we film, you know, we try to film it in more of a third person style, to where the videographer essentially puts the audience into the moment. And so I have the static cameras if I'm unable to, so I can still investigate the larger locations. If I'm not able to spend a lot of time in one area, I still have the static cameras. But then most of my investigations will consist of that following around and kind of in the moment type experiments.
Yeah, this past summer I did a 8-part series on Berkshire's UFO. And I had Marcus Clark was one of my guests, and he was the director for Netflix's Unsolved Mysteries.
Yes.
And he was telling me, you know, how he likes to have his cameras tell the story, you know.
Yes.
And I get that from yours. I get that a lot of times your camera is actually telling a story.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that's great.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm glad you noticed that, because that's one of the things that was really important to me in this, is to be able to put the person in the moment and hopefully be able to kind of, I guess, maybe add that suspense or the excitement of being in this location. You know, I mean, and really try to tell the story too on several levels. One, that sometimes the investigation can be a little bit slower, you know, so I like to show that, you know, sometimes we don't get things. but then also show in those moments of when we're able to capture that unexpected activity. And the beautiful thing in season one and two was that Josh was not a paranormal investigator. And originally, he was just going to help me sort of film the shots that maybe I couldn't get for my trailers, you know, while I was on the motorcycle or while I was doing several different things, some B-roll to kind of put in there. But he went on an investigation with me, and it was really kind of hard. Once we started getting a little bit of activity, it was really kind of hard for him to hide that emotion or that excitement from some of the things that were happening. Because, you know, when you experience this stuff for the first time, it can really be quite a startling experience. And so, I mean, he's always been a believer, but it was more just he hadn't gone out seeking it. And so when the first activity happened, I remember he gasped and he said something, and then he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, I'm not supposed to speak." And I was like, you know, I actually kind of like that. He ended up becoming a central figure in the episodes just because it seemed like a lot of the activity knew that he wasn't an investigator. And sometimes, you know, being that, I guess, silent fly on the wall that's following and trying to tell this story, it seemed like at times they wanted to sort of challenge him to not be so silent, I guess. And they were often touching him or reacting with the equipment. So it really added a nice element in that storytelling way, you know, as far as being able to be there, not be the investigator. But I think it really helped to create an identifiable character, because a lot of the people who follow my episodes aren't really paranormal enthusiasts, or maybe they're more paranormal enthusiasts, but not so much paranormal investigators. So it really added a relatable person and really helped to tell that story that we were trying to tell.
Yeah, I was curious because, you know, if you're traveling on your bike, you know, how do you fit all the equipment in your saddlebags?
The beautiful thing, my drone, I actually have a backpack. It's a hard shell case that the drone and several of my gimbals and stuff will fit into this hard shell case. But usually if it's a larger location, I've sort of created these drop kits that have battery powered cameras that I'm able to, you know, put in my saddlebags efficiently. I have four of those, as well as a go bag that has my essential equipment for that particular investigation. But if I am going somewhere larger, a lot of the time my videographer doesn't ride. And like I said, in season three, Christy Sumner from Soul Sisters, she helped me out with filming, and, you know, they carried the cameras in their vehicle, some of the larger equipment in their vehicle.
Yeah, she was great. I had her as past guest this past summer.
Yes, she's wonderful.
You two work kind of similar, you know, with the trigger items and the type of equipment you use.
I was going to say, we actually met through the paranormal. We were actually following each other's videos and didn't realize it. And she reached out to me, and she's one that I will actually collaborate quite a bit with at different locations, just because I have great respect for her team and their style of investigating. You know, it's very similar to mine. You know, I feel I can learn a lot from them, as well as, you know, we mesh really well together at some of these different locations that we've investigated.
I think you're from Tennessee, right?
Yes, sir. Yes. Chattanooga area.
Chattanooga. So you're not really too far from my family in Alabama.
Not at all. Yeah. Right on the line.
I recognize the accent, you know.
Yes.
I always asked Uncle Carl, you know, if he talks like me, Northerner, but my Aunt Glenda, she talks like this. How do you have that Southern accent and Uncle Carl doesn't? You both grew up in Alabama. You both went to the same school, your high school sweethearts. And he doesn't talk like he's from the South.
It, you know, I've always been fascinated, and actually just shared, you know, a video about, you know, mountain talk and vernacular. You know, that's something I've always been fascinated with. You know, the hauntings are so different around the country, and the whole hauntings in the South that's just something that's always fascinated me, the, you know, Appalachian Haints and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And just in Tennessee alone, the accents vary just from East, Middle, and Western Tennessee, even up into Northern Tennessee. There's probably about five different dialects or vernaculars just in, you know, in just the state of Tennessee alone.
Yeah, because I'm the only coolie that lives in Ohio. All my family's in Alabama. I was seeing on here that on some of your locations that you went to, you know, in Tennessee, mm-hmm. like how do you pick those locations?
Several different ways, actually. You know, so what I like to do with my show is I like to hit the smaller, lesser known locations. I love to investigate and visit the larger ones, you know, the Waverly Hills and the, you know, sanatoriums and those different locations. I like to go to those, but as far as my show, I really like to hit those small locations. A lot of time, either people will reach out to me and they'll tell me about somewhere that's kind of interesting, has a interesting history that I should check out, or an interesting haunting that they've heard about. You know, I'm always telling people that if you close your eyes and touch a map, you can't touch anywhere on that map that you won't find a location that doesn't have some type of interesting story or haunting. You know, it may just be regionally known, but it may also be nationally known. You know, a lot of these places are in our own backyard, or, you know, there might be a building or a certain location that people have driven past all their life and they don't always know the history of it. So they'll reach out to me to either research that story more, or, you know, kind of look into it and share it with other people. That was the case with the Bleeding Mausoleum in Cleveland, Tennessee. You know, that was the first episode that I covered. And I had a lot of people that had lived in Cleveland all their lives come to me afterwards and say, I've always seen this building. I did not know the entire family tragic history behind it. And so so I'll get those stories from people that come to me and tell me those, or I like to read a lot of the local books on, you know, like for instance, maybe like Haunted Birmingham or Haunted Chattanooga. And I get a lot of stories from those that I take and try to look deeper into them by going and visiting the archives and researching, maybe talking to people to see what I can find out more. One of the stories that I covered in season three, it was the 1944 troop train wreck. I actually saw that when I was riding up into Kentucky from Tennessee, riding up through Jellicoe. Just on this backwoods mountain road, I passed this sign, and it was like a little 8x8 sign that said 1944 troop train accident viewing area. And, you know, it was just on this power pole, and you couldn't even see the site area because it had grown up so much. And there wasn't even a pull-off area except for maybe like a quarter of a mile up the road. And so I went back, researched, and found out that it was in the top 25 train wrecks in the U.S. And it was the number one most horrific troop train accident, and found this amazing history about this tragic event. And so sometimes they're just kind of happy little accidents that maybe I see along the road when I'm riding. But those are typically the three ways that I'll, you know, find the different locations that I hit. A lot of the time it is word of mouth.
Yeah. When you were talking about Cleveland, I kept thinking Cleveland, Ohio, you know, cause it's not like, you know, 50 miles from here. But that was really an interesting story with the, Nina?
Yes, and the Caldwell family, or Cragmiles, excuse me.
Right, and falling on that train track, and you walk around the mausoleum seven times?
Yes.
Calling out her name?
Mm-hmm. And on the end time, you invite her to come out and play with you. And that's something that a lot of the natives in Cleveland told me after the fact, that, you know, they grew up, it was one of the things where they would be challenged, you know, to with their friends to go to the mausoleum and walk around it and see if they could get Nina to interact and play with them. And it just seemed like a very fitting starting point for this, because it was an accessible location. it was relatively a simple investigation. I went on two nights and was able to just sort of take my time asking questions and seeing if I could get any activity. And then just the story behind it was so interesting that I felt like even if I didn't get any type of activity there, the story was interesting enough that people would want to watch, you know, just because it is so tragic, and just for every member of the family. And then with the marble supposedly bleeding, you know, every time that a new member was put into the mausoleum, it was just something that it just seemed like a very good starting point, and just nothing earth shattering as far as evidence that I got, but I felt just good, honest investigating with a great story to go along with it.
Yeah, I've always found that during investigations, you know, whoever you're trying to contact, you know, the spirit, they pick who they want to talk to, who they want to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Bring up your accent. I was in one time when three paranormal different groups were in the building, and nobody can get the a contact with them, no matter what they're using, what kind of equipment or anything. It was a young lady standing in the back by herself that this person decided to contact her.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of her accent. She loved her accent. The spirit was from the South.
Exactly. I mean, I've found in different locations, because I've investigated with many different teams and on many different collaborations, and found that, I mean, it's like, you know, when you're dealing with a living person, we have our preferences and our comfort level. And I have found that where, you know, some spirits have interacted more with females, or interacted with someone of a specific, I guess, accent or from a specific region, they just felt more comfortable communicating with them. It's interesting that you've noticed that, because I've noticed that as well on different places. And because sometimes I always tell people, just because I go to this specific location and I don't get anything, it doesn't mean it's not haunted or that it's not active. It may just mean that they just didn't want to talk to me, or they just didn't want to interact with me on that particular night for whatever reason.
So have you ever had any physical contact with any investigations?
I have, on several different ones. One of the locations that I covered was, I called it the House on Sunset Hill, and it was located between Cleveland, Tennessee and Charleston, Tennessee. And it ended up being a case, a full year long case for me. And it was one that I covered in both season one and season two. It was something that was a little bit different from the typical legends and lore type places that I would visit. But I was actually at this location investigating a haunted relic for episode two, which was a haunted tub. And it was being stored in an abandoned house. And while we were filming, and usually when I'm on these locations, unless I'm collaborating with another team, it's always just myself and a camera person, or just myself. And on this particular occasion, it was myself and a camera person. And so we were filming the story as well as filming some B-roll. And we kept getting activity coming from this house. And so I reached out to the homeowner who had let me come in to investigate this haunted tub. And she was telling me that, you know, she had in fact had activity when she lived there. So I asked if I could do a full-scale investigation. And as I'd said a minute ago, it turned into a full year-long case. But at this particular place, you would get pushed, sometimes scratched. This location was unlike any other, as in the fact that, you know, a lot of the time when you go to a place, once the cameras come on, it's almost like things just kind of get a little quiet, maybe, you know, takes a little while to get the action going. But at this place, it was totally opposite of that. It's like it craved the attention. And if you didn't acknowledge it, or if you didn't communicate when you went in there, because I did several different experiments where I wouldn't even acknowledge or wouldn't interact when I would go in, it would do everything it could. And that would include pushing you or you know, pulling on your hair, that sort of thing, just to get your attention and just to get you to acknowledge it on the camera.
I know you were saying like the, with the room with the tub in it, mm-hmm. it was over like 90 degrees out there, and yet you felt a cold breeze behind you and cameraman. I think yes. He was a little startled. I think you stopped production.
We did.
To regroup yourself or?
You know, it's really important to me to document because, and I learned through doing this of just, you know, constantly keeping the camera going because it may not happen, you know, when you're actually doing the investigation, but when you're doing something else. And we found that when I was feeling like that cold breeze and stuff, equipment behind me was lighting up. I could feel something behind me. The K2 meter instantly at that moment lit up. And of course, I didn't know it had done that until I went back to look at my film where I was documenting. But yes, at that moment, my camera guy said it was like something grabbed his ears. He could feel an intense heat. I was feeling cold and he could feel an intense heat and just like something grabbing his ears. And I could tell when I looked at him, it was a clear physical reaction because his color dropped from his face and it was like he was paralyzed, you know? And so we stopped the filming for a few minutes to regroup and actually ended up stepping out of the house because it just felt like things were getting a little too intense to continue at that moment. Of course, we were able to go back in and continue. That house is definitely one of the most intense places that I've ever investigated. It's definitely one of the most active.
Was that the one with the monk?
Yes, it was. What's interesting about it is it started out, you know, it started with the investigation of the monk and the tub and then led into, that was the house where the monk's tub was, but it led into, you know, these other five spirits that we found to be staying in this house. You know, we did get activity that we felt was related to the monk with the tub, but that investigation, we also investigated the train wreck where the monk had lost his life and the train wreck site up in Charleston, Tennessee.
So have you ever felt yourself in danger? You thought you weren't safe there?
I did start to get threatening responses when I would go in there. Just before we'd just come off of a live and I was setting up the cameras, and it was actually a very, very intense live. And it was supposed to only be about a 15-minute live where I was setting up these cameras, and I had pre-recorded questions that different people who watched the show had sent in and wanted me to ask. And so after we had done the live, I was setting up the cameras and getting the recorders ready, and I started feeling really dizzy. And all of a sudden the camera, the battery powered camera that I had set up, fell. It shot off the shelf and I was feeling just real dizzy. And right before it shot off the shelf, we get as clear as can be on, and this was just straight up EVP out of the air, with no assistance of spirit box or anything like that, just straight out of the air. It says, "Miranda, you're going to die." And I didn't hear it in the moment, but that night after we had gone home and I was kind of reviewing the video from the live and reviewing my audio, I heard it. So when I had to go pick my cameras up the next day, because I left this to run overnight, I was a little nervous walking in there. Because not a lot of places, there's been only one other place that I've had my name actually called. And that was at Hell's Bar Dam. But this location, this house, I was going in there so much and conducting so many different experiments that I felt that the entities that I was speaking with really had kind of grown familiar with me. So there were a few moments where things started to feel uncomfortable, and we would remove ourselves from the situations if that was to happen. For me, it's kind of knowing when to say when. And for me, typically the locations that I go to, I don't typically go seeking out the darker entities. Usually each season I will cover a darker location just because it is fascinating. but I like to really do the local legends, lore, and stories that have a more historical base to them is typically what I like to do. So if it's a location that, you know, I feel in danger or whatever, I will remove myself from that situation.
We'll be right back with the rest of my interview with ghost biker Miranda Young. This will be the last year that I'm affiliated with Indie Blast Podcast Network, and it has been a really fun ride this year being part of the Indie Blast Podcast Network and all my friends and podcasters over there. It has been really my privilege to be part of this group. Now back to ghost biker Miranda Young.
Yeah, I did find that there's a difference between, you know, a spirit that just doesn't want you there to
right.
a demonic spirit.
Yes.
Years ago when I started this, you know, I remember asking our priest the dangers of that, you know, and he said there's a thin line there, you know, and mm-hmm. once you cross that line that you want and you go into that danger, that area mm-hmm. of a demonic area, it's hard to get out of that area, you know. So
yes.
So then my next question would be, do you believe that you could move a spirit on?
I myself, no, it's not something that I do. You know, I feel I'm not qualified for that. Now, you know, that house in particular, I did end up calling a demonologist in because the homeowner, she was an elderly lady and she rarely, in fact, for her, she never went into the house. After it had been vacant for 10 years, after 8 or 9 years, she didn't go in there other than to have someone come and mow the yard. And so she was actually decided to renovate it and turn it into a rental property. And so after all the stuff that we had found, she was not comfortable renting it out because there was some negativity in that house. And so I did reach out to a demonologist that I had met. He reviewed my case, looked at everything that we had found in the past year, and came up and he ended up letting us go along on his, he called it a home liberation, but he let us go along and actually film it, which is something he typically didn't do. And we set up different pieces of equipment and caught some pretty cool things. Some things that he was really impressed with, because typically he didn't, you know, have recorders and different tools and stuff going when he would do his part. So I myself know, but if it is a situation that is requiring a home liberation or a home cleansing or blessing or anything like that, I will, I have some people that I'll reach out to and they'll review it and take it from there. I just, for me, it's knowing when to say when. And for any residential cases that I do, I typically don't put those out there in a video unless it's something different and they're okay with that. You know, so when I'm called in, it's typically to just sort of either try to debunk or validate some of the activity that they're having. Most people haven't wanted to get rid of what's going on because it hasn't been so extreme. It's more or less just, you know, making sure that either they're kind of helping to confirm they don't feel crazy, you know, but there have been a couple times that I've had to reach out to someone else to come in and do that sort of thing.
I do like on the disclosure you put on, I think one of the videos about not playing around railroad tracks or take them seriously. So I was always fascinated with the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I love the way your video started with the train track in Cleveland.
Yes.
And it took you up to the Monks 20 miles away, the same train track. That was interesting.
Yes. You know, and one thing I've noticed, I'm like you, I've also always been fascinated by the railroad and trains. And it just so happened we were able to tie those together, you know, with that. And so it was a nice little mix to be able to tie in the railroad into pretty much all of season two. But I found that most of my seasons have some type of episode that has involved a railroad or trains, just because there is so much history and really so much tragedy involving all of that.
Yeah, like the all the soldiers that passed away on that.
Yes.
The train track that collapsed on a different episode.
Yes. And so, I always like to, when I'm doing a season, if I can, I like to try to tie the stuff together. And the railroad has definitely been something that's been a common theme throughout all three seasons and will actually be part in season four as well.
You've been asked this question 1,000 times. What type of equipment do you use for investigation?
I use a variety, but like I said, you know, I do kind of have to keep it light, and I try to really plan out each investigation so that I have the essentials and have trigger items and such that are tailored for that specific location. But definitely always have my mobile recorder that I keep on me, as well as some different static recorders that I'll set down and place in different areas. So my recorder is one of my favorites. I love my dowsing rods. I take those with me, and I really like those because they are very simple. And a lot of the spirits that, first of all, you don't have to worry about the battery drain with those. And then a lot of the spirits that I'm speaking with, they are familiar with what those are. So you're not asking them to go and touch a light or touch something that they may feel uncomfortable with. And then they're easy as well. You know, typically yes or no questions or pointing to a different area in the room. So I always have my dowsing rods, and I love my EDI box because I don't know if you're familiar with an EDI plus.
I'm not, no.
Okay. So I call it a science box. You know, it's a probably a little 6-inch tall box, and it has temperature, it has the pressure, it has an EMF reader. It also has a geophone that will detect vibrations and movement. So I always have that with me in different areas so that I can keep track of the temperature in real time. You know, if one of my flashlights goes off, that's great. But if I have the EDI box with it and I'm getting, you know, changes in EMF or changes in vibration or whatever, I can correlate the two together. So that's one I always have with me. And then I've got my typical kind of bells and whistles that a lot of investigators use with the REM pod. I use flashlights a lot, but I use multiple flashlights when I'm doing that.
I see you use candles also.
Yes, I do. And, depending on the location, if the location allows it, because I've had a lot of luck with candles, as far as I even had in one instance, something try to blow the candle out. That was really cool. And then one location, we found out that the little girl we were speaking to had passed away in a fire, and she was absolutely terrified of the candles. And so when we blew the candles out, I mean, they told us they wanted us to turn them off. We blew them out and we started getting activity. So if the location allows it, that's one that I like to do. I also like my SLS camera, but I like to use it. It's another one that I like to use in conjunction with other things. You know, you do get a lot of false positives on that, but I have had where I've mapped a figure and mapped it near my EDI box and was able to, on command, ask to touch the EDI box. And we saw on the SLS figure touch the box at the exact same time that the pressure and the temperature changed on the box, which was, I thought, pretty compelling. So those are the ones, you know, I've got others, like I said, that I'll change out, but those are the pieces that I typically will take with me on each investigation.
I have to touch on this one. Your grandmother, mm-hmm. You had mentioned how she was a great influence on you younger, and a story she told you. Could you share maybe a story you remember growing up?
I remember so many. A lot of the ones she had told, you know, were ones that either she had experienced or ones that other folks there in the Appalachians, and, you know, and she would share different things, a lot of folklore and that sort of thing. But, you know, one of them in particular that I remember, she was talking about a little girl who, you know, they lived in several different places, but they lived in this mountain holler. And one of them in particular was a little girl who had lived down the road from her, and that she is a friend, and she was on one particular night, she was not there, but her little friend's brothers and sisters were, and they were dancing around the coals from where they had been burning a fire, and they were running through the coals, and her little friend had ended up passing away. She stepped in on one of the coals, and from my understanding, the fire was, you know, it was still really hot, and she ended up falling, and she ended up passing away. And she tells the story, she didn't find out about it until like a day or two later about her friend who had ended up passing away. But she said that that night she had seen outside of one of her windows a little girl looking in that had a dark face. And so she thought it was her friend, and that she had seen like the coals where she had fallen into the fire. And so she thought her friend had come over and was just, you know, looking in the window, but she wasn't there. And then, like I said, 2 days later, she found out that her friend had passed away. She also would tell me the story of her uncle who had passed away, and that he came to her house, and he was passing through, and she asked him if she was going to fix him some coffee. And so she went to ask him if he wanted some, and he just kind of kept on walking through, and come to find out, she received word that he had passed away. And she thought that was, the timing was right around the time that he had passed through the house. So that's two of the stories that I remember really, really fondly that she had told me, that of things she had experienced.
So I take it she was a believer in the folklore.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. She, you know, she was always talking about, you know, different things that fascinate me now. You know, I wish that, she passed away in 2003, and so I was 23 at the time. And a lot of these stories she would tell me were stories from back in the day when I was a kid and truly couldn't appreciate it, I guess, you know, looking back at it now. But, you know, she would talk about everything from being able to tell the winners from looking at woolly worms to people who, you know, were like the seventh son of a seventh son, you know, that could heal different people, you know, sort of almost kind of like mountain magic in a way. And so those were a lot of stories that she told me as well, as far as, you know, hanging the horseshoes over the doors, or, you know, different things as far as things you shouldn't do, like, you know, sweeping under someone's feet.
Mm-hmm.
And those sort of things. So she shared a lot of that. The majority of our time that I spent down there, which was pretty much every day, there was always something that she was telling me about, you know, when cooking bread and how to, you know, make the, you know, certain things to do to, so that the bread comes out right. And it all came from things, you know, growing up there in the mountains that she had experienced, you know. So yeah, she was a big influence and imparted the importance of storytelling on me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I do like the way you really include the history on the story and, you know, the location you're investigating, and most importantly, the person that you're trying to contact.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for mentioning that too. You know, because the story is always, for me, the most important part. Everyone can catch up on the past three seasons. They can watch those on YouTube under Ghost Biker Explorations, or on the Facebook page, which is also under Ghost Biker Explorations. Or they can, you know, see anything and everything that I'm doing as far as events, listen to past interviews and that sort of thing on my website under www.ghostbikerexplorations.com. And then they can follow my photography on Instagram under Runaway Vixen.
All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Take care.
Thank you, Miranda Young, for that great interview from Ghost Biker Explorations. You can find her on YouTube under Ghost Biker Explorations, Facebook, and you can check out her photography on Instagram under Runaway Vixen. I will have all those links in the bottom of this podcast. And thank you, Nate Wade, for letting me be part of the Indie Blast Podcast Network. And I'll see you all in 3 weeks on Ghosts in the Valley Podcast.
Podcast Network.